If I were more of a mystic than I am, I would say that God was saying something to us. When I go on a Sunday that I'm going to speak on this election and I suddenly lift up the scriptures from its place and under the pulpit and suddenly all that's below there capsizes. The story is about Elijah, the doughty champion of God, which are told in the scriptures, are among the most enigmatic and the most mysterious. We're told, for instance, in the book of Kings, that Elijah summoned all of the leaders of Israel to Mount Carmel at one time. He proposed to organize there a great trial of strength between the Baalim, the fertility gods of Canaan, and Adonai, Israel's God. He would have the priests of Baal arrange a sacrifice on one altar, and he would arrange a sacrifice to the one God on another altar. And the true God, the puissant God, would show his strength by suddenly causing a flame, fire, to emerge spontaneously on one altar or the other. And before this test of the power of the gods or the one God, Elijah turned to the leaders and he said to them, in an attempt to get them to stop vacillating between idolatry and monotheism, "For how long will you hop around between two opinions? If God is the Lord, follow him. And if Baal be God, then follow him." Now, I suspect that most of us have been saying just that to ourselves. How long are we going to keep hopping around between two opinions? If Jimmy Carter has proven his qualifications to another 4 years as President of the United States, we'll vote for him. If Ronald Reagan has shown that he is of presidential timber, we'll vote for him. But the answer doesn't come. If the polls are accurate, and if what I hear echoed in our conversations is an accurate barometer of feeling, there are many millions who are still hopping around between two opinions, wishing that Elijah would suddenly come down and organize a test, and so that we could learn, you know, by some method whom we should vote for. And I suspect further that many of us were looking on Tuesday night in the great debate, the great non-debate, as the test which would finally enlighten us, cause the flame spontaneously to light on the altar. But Tuesday night didn't prove very much, except that the Cleveland Chamber of Commerce got a few points. We learned again what we'd always known, that Mr. Carter is a quick study, that he can master a great number of facts and figures which are not necessarily relevant to the question that's being asked. And that we learned that Mr. Reagan has a warm and professional way of presenting commonplaces and conventional ideas which also are not necessarily relevant to the question that is being asked. And so here we are, 2 days before the election. Intelligent men and women who recognize that not to choose is itself a choice. Troubled, tentative, even if in our minds we have decided we'll vote this way or that way, we know that something could happen, some particular persuasive argument could come along which might cause us to change our minds. Last weekend we drove up to Niagara Falls. It's a dull drive. And I decided to keep my mind alert so I would not swerve the car off into another car, by counting bumper stickers and taking my own poll as to the presidential preferences of Americans. It's a 4-hour drive up, it's a 4-hour drive back. For part of the way, we went off of the superhighway, so cars were coming at us in both directions. And within an hour, I gave up my poll because there was nothing to count. In 8 hours of driving, I saw less than a dozen bumper stickers for any candidate, any of the three major presidential candidates. I saw bumper stickers for county commissioners, for members of the House of Congress, but not for the presidency. It's an election in which most of us really are not looking forward to entering the voting booth. I saw again in the paper this morning that cartoon which has become famous, the voting booth, the open curtain, the sign, you know, abandon hope all ye who enter here. It really should say, now you have to make up your minds. Now why? Why are we having such troubles? It's rather strange in one sense, because the two men are not evil men. Both of them have proven that they work hard. They've been competent in professions before they entered into politics and public service. Both of them are self-made men who fit the American image of young men coming from small towns who raised themselves by their bootstraps to financial success and the respect of others. Both of them are financially greedy men, but that's not necessarily considered to be a vice in many areas of American life. Both men have devoted years to public service and have many fine accomplishments to their credit. Why then are we having such troubles? The answer, I think, lies in the very nature of American politics. Our presidential elections are not elections of party leaders, but of national leaders. Unlike most of the other free nations of the world, our politics are not ideological. Our parties are not ideological parties, Labor, Tory. Rather, they are agglomerations of people come together for a whole variety of reasons. And the man whom we elect is above his party, is not really beholden to them. And the cabinet, the administration, and he will nominate, will work with him, will represent his desires and his wills. And so, uniquely among the free societies of the world, American presidential elections depend upon the quality of the person. In France, England, in West Germany, in Italy, you vote for a party. The party elects its leadership. And there is less concern with the personal qualities of the leaders because you know where the party stands on the economic and international issues which immediately affect your well-being. That's why in those countries there's such a high percentage of voters, because the voters know exactly who represents what they assume to be their needs. Not so here. Here we elect a man. And we look for the qualities of character, generosity of spirit, of understanding, which are necessary to govern a power of such as ours. Now, given the quality of the two men, why are we having such problems? Because I would submit they lack that one thing for which we are most desperately searching. And what is that? Wisdom. Wisdom. Common sense in an uncommon degree. The ability to work through the problems of our times and make clear to us, the American people, some vision of how we're going to face the next few years. We've come to one of those crossroads in American political life. The past is behind us. The years of uncontested American power, the years of unlimited American prosperity, these are over. We're in a new era. We're in an era where we have double-digit inflation, which seems to be intractable, a degree of unemployment with which we really do not seem to be able to handle. where we must share our power with other nations and peoples throughout the world, often in ways that cause us great difficulty. We are not the nation that we once were, but we're still a strong and powerful nation and a prosperous nation. And we need somebody who has the wisdom to think through with us the problems that confront us and help us to understand where we're going and how we're going to get there. And none of the candidates have had the ability to do that for us. Mr. Carter is a technician, an engineer. He has an ability to absorb a large amount of material having to do with a very specific and narrow problem. But often when he's tried to explain a problem to us, we found we've been overwhelmed, drowned by facts and figures. We really don't know any more than when we began, and we certainly don't know how his proposed solution to an energy problem or to a tax problem or to a foreign relation problem fits in with everything else in the that faces us as a nation. He's an awkward speaker. He has no talent for powerful verbal images. He's a problem solver rather than a man of breadth, of vision, a man of wisdom. Now, Mr. Reagan has, I think, won both of the debates in which he has engaged. Not because he's a wise man, but because his style gives us the semblance of wisdom. He has the ability to speak simply. He can craft a powerful image. He knows how to speak to the heart rather than simply to the mind. But unfortunately, in his case, so much of what he says is commonplace. He's dealing with the past, with nostalgia, rather than really confronting the problems of the present and of tomorrow. And so neither man has been able to present to us in this time when America is groping for understanding and self-understanding, the wisdom which we need to face the future. And because of that lack, neither man has been able to develop the kind of energy to his campaign, the kind of loyalty to his cause, which would summon the respect and the vote of the great mass of Americans who are moderate, in the middle, committed to the old values, but committed also to turning towards the future and facing it as we need to. For most of us, if we're honest, this election was decided months ago. It was decided during the primaries. At the very latest, it was decided during the national conventions. But the truth is that America does not lack people of quality, of competence, men and someday we would hope women who, with the experience behind them, who could wrestle with the contentious problems of the day and speak to us wisely of the needs of tomorrow. 13 months ago, when this campaign began in the party caucuses in Iowa and in the fields of New Hampshire, there were other names that were being bruited about. Muskie, Church, Baker, Bush, Jackson, Brown. What happened? The problem, I think, of this election is the problem of the primaries. The primaries represent a reform in American political life which is in need of reform. And it's not simply that they're too long. It's the very nature of the primary mitigates against men who are busy, against people who are active, who are moderate, who represent the great middle of America becoming the nominees of their party. How so? Why was Cleveland so eager to have the debate? Because we wanted to develop a positive national image. The debate would bring into Cleveland the newspaper reporters, the television cameras, because we would become visible in a good way. Why have primaries proliferated across the land and some primaries moved earlier and earlier back into the months before the convention. Until now, the first primary is really a year before the Democratic and Republican conventions. Again, because for financial and public relations reasons, it's important to a small state like New Hampshire, to a farm state like Iowa, to other states, to attract attention to themselves, for their own purposes, not for the purposes of electing a president. It's attractive to feel that one will be significant, one state will be significant in the process. Now, it costs several $1 million to run a primary campaign today. Television and radio and the professionals who've involved themselves in this are terribly expensive. And one must commit not only 14 or 15 months of one's life to the search for nomination, but somebody else's millions of dollars. Very few of the candidates are like Governor Rockefeller of West Virginia, who, it was reported in the papers today, has spent over $9 million of his own money in order to run for re-election in that state. Very few candidates have that kind of money, and we certainly would not want our choice among presidential candidates to be limited to the few multi-billionaires in the country. But you need money. You need a staff. The long primary road favors, first of all, the incumbent, who has a staff, who has an ability to command public attention, who has already established his name in the public mind, who has access to the party coffers. The long primary campaign favors the person who has had nothing else to do but to run around for the last 3 or 4 years, as Mr. Nixon did before his reelection 12 years ago, and as Mr. Reagan did in the years between 1976 and 1980, raising money for his party and therefore developing the ability to tap the party for money. It favors the incumbent, it favors the fundraiser, and it favors the extremist. Because as the mass media people will tell you, those who raise money by mail solicitation otherwise, money is there to be raised from those who are the most angry, who want to go on a crusade. And if you will speak to them of their crusade, the money will come in. The moderate, the person whose wisdom we might prefer, is not likely to command a crusade. The crusades have come from the extremes of American political life, not from the great center. The moderate is not likely to have 4 years to spend doing nothing but raising money for his party. And unless by some quirk of fate he has become the president of the United States, he's not likely, therefore, to stand in line to be nominated for the presidency of the United States. Now, the primary campaign became a fact in American life as a reform. Early in this century, people wanted to take the nomination, the president, away from the Mark Hannas, away from the smoke-filled rooms, and give us a voice in the nomination. But over the years, things have changed. It worked well for a while. It doesn't work well any longer. It's too long a process. It's too costly a process. It's a process which favors those who were not necessarily representative of the great American middle. It's a reform which I submit to you is badly in need of being reformed. Will we survive this election? Yes. We'll muddle through, to use Churchill's phrase. You think we'll muddle through, you believe it. And the test of that is the fate of Mr. Anderson's campaign. It's hard to remember that just 3 months ago, after the two national conventions, some of the pundits and the pollsters were predicting that Mr. Anderson might receive as much as 25% of the popular vote. Mr. Anderson has always been the neither of the above candidates. His candidacy represents the feeling that we could not survive the presidency of either of the two major party candidates. The fact that 15% has dwindled to 10 in the polls and 10 to 8 and 7 suggests that most Americans are convinced that we will survive another 4 years of Mr. Carter, or 4 years of Mr. Reagan. Although I must say that I hope that come Tuesday, Mr. Anderson receives enough votes to qualify for the federal election financial assistance, which he will qualify for if he receives 5% of the national vote. For I must say that he has served the national purpose well. He has raised issues, but neither of the other candidates were willing to do so. What kind of a campaign has it been? Well, it's been an issueless campaign. Mr. Carter is for the Equal Rights Amendment. Mr. Reagan is for every provision of the Equal Rights Amendment, but not for the idea of an amendment. Mr. Carter is for the ratification of the SALT II arms control treaty with the Soviet Union. Mr. Reagan professes that he's for arms control and for an agreement, a treaty on arms control with the Soviet Union, but he objects to some of the provisions in the SALT II treaty. He would like a SALT III treaty. Mr. Reagan is for an increased national defense budget. Mr. Carter is now saying that in the last years of his administration, he has already increased the national defense budget and intends to do so. Mr. Reagan is for a major 3-year across-the-board tax cut, and Mr. Carter is also for a tax cut on a different basis. Where are the issues? Where are the substantial issues between the men? Neither of the men has really confronted the specific needs of the nation. That's why I say they both have lacked in wisdom. What then has this campaign been about? Well, I think it's been about values. 4 years ago, Mr. Carter was elected largely because he developed a congregation, and I'm using the religious terminology deliberately, a congregation of people beyond those who normally vote the Democratic ticket, who believed that it was time for the American spirit to come to Washington and clean out the Augean stables and bring back the old values. And what has happened in this election, essentially, is that Mr. Reagan has taken over Mr. Carter's old congregation. In his acceptance speech, Mr. Reagan spoke of a community of values embodied in the American spirit, embodied in 5 words. The words were family, work, neighborhood, freedom, peace. Lovely words. Now, these were the words on which Mr. Carter ran for an election for 18 months in 1975 and 1976. These are the words which Mr. Reagan has made central to his rhetoric in 1980. They are words, obviously, which are compelling to a large number of Americans who are concerned that we seem to have lost our way. We seem to be going in all directions at once. But some of the values which are we think of as instinctive to American life seem to be disappearing. And so the question is, how did Mr. Carter lose his congregation? And what does Mr. Reagan mean by his rhetoric? How did Mr. Carter lose his congregation? He lost his congregation because there's a gap between the sermon and the street. Because it's always difficult to translate values into practical programs. Because when he got into power, he found that there were mitigating circumstances, things he could not accomplish, things he no longer wanted to accomplish. He no longer spoke to the congregation in the terms to which they would recite instinctively, amen. Family. It's one thing to be for a family, to be pro-family. But it's another thing to govern a country where, for economic and other reasons, a majority of the women have elected to go to work. It's one thing to be pro-family. It's another thing to represent a country where a majority of people seem to favor the Equal Rights Amendment. What about work? Well, it's one thing to favor work in the abstract and to say that one ought to get the benefits of one's labor. It's another thing to be president of a country where there is an underclass which is undereducated and under-talented and under-trained and antisocial and who simply cannot be brought into the labor force but who must somehow be sustained. It's one thing to be in favor of neighborhoods and quite another to be the president of the United States, bound, pledged to the Constitution, governed now by court decisions which have mandated busing and other such anti-neighborhood activities as the law of the land. And it's one thing to believe in freedom and the responsible use of power to protect freedom, and quite another to be able to find the ways in which one responsibly uses power in order to sustain freedom. Teddy White called Mr. Carter, when he came to Washington, a naïf. An innocent. He was innocent. In many ways, I think he still is. But you cannot remain innocent in many areas for long in Washington because the statements that you make are no longer purely sermonic. They have immediate consequence on the lives of millions of people. And in trying to work through, to learn on the job, Mr. Carter was unable to convince millions of Americans that he had retained the values of the past, the things he talked about from the pulpit, and that he was energetically and actively trying to weave these into the context of American life. He failed miserably at that task, not for want of trying, but for a lack of ability to communicate, and because he didn't have the wisdom to put it all into a simple, direct, meaningful perspective. He seemed always to be vacillating, to be coming at a problem because it had been thrust at him, thinking he'd solve a problem, putting it aside, never integrating all our problems into a common whole. So Mr. Reagan picked up where Mr. Carter left off. And if Mr. Reagan is elected as President of the United States next Tuesday, when he comes into power in January, he's going to face the same problem that Mr. Carter has faced in the last 4 years. Because it's one thing to enunciate values and quite another to tie them into legislation, to weave them into the fabric of American life. He's going to find it's very difficult to take the values of the past and find ways in which one can make them clear, visible, in this very in the present, which is so full of convulsion and change and uncertainty. I think Mr. Carter lost his congregation for another reason. It has to do with the spirit of the man. You expect a religious leader to be a man of principle, to be a man of honor, and to be just a little bit less concerned with his own success than the average run of folk. That's the danger of anybody, by the way, who gets elected as a cleric rather than as a politician. Mr. Carter has a streak in him which is a very defensive streak. Some have called it a mean streak. And I suspect there isn't a group in America which can't point to one or two instances in which his concern for his own reelection, for his own constituency, did not stand in his way of his doing the right thing. As a Jew, I'll never forget that long Mississippi River steamboat ride that he took several years ago. It was just after Andrew Young had been forced to resign as our ambassador to the United Nations. The word was being put out by some of Mr. Young's supervisors that he had been forced out by Jewish pressure. The issue, you recall, was his meeting with the representatives of the Palestine Liberation Organization. In point of fact, Mr. Young had been forced to resign because he had directly disobeyed an order of his superiors. It was a very serious community relations issue for the Jewish community. Mr. Carter was on his boat, and for 3 days, he refused to be interviewed on the issue, letting the charge lie there,
on a single sentence of his explaining the reasons for the resignation might have cleared things up. But he was concerned about Mr. Young's constituency, the black vote, the vote which had elected him in 1976, and the words were never spoken. One who preaches must expect to be judged by the same morality that he demands of those he preaches about. It's easy to see the other fellow's mistakes, but if you're going to see them and talk about them publicly, you better be prepared to have people point out your own. Which brings us to the Jewish sides of this campaign. Isn't it delightful to have a campaign where the major issue is the Christian vote and not the Jewish vote? For once, nobody is going at us and blaming us for voting in a block way, one way or another. They're going at each other, and that's become much more of an issue. How do the two men stand on what is assumed to be the basic issue of the Jewish community in Israel? Well, it all depends by what standards you judge. Campaign rhetoric, by what standards you judge a presidential accomplishment. Mr. Carter has, in the last days, found good reason to go to a Forest Hills synagogue, a Philadelphia Young Men's Hebrew Association meeting, and he's spoken there about the many billions of dollars that America has given in foreign military aid to Israel during his incumbency, and it's true, but he's not added that there would have been no foreign aid bill if Israel had not been part of that measure. He's spoken of the significance of the Camp David Accords, in which he played such a central role, a role which ought not to be minimized, but he fails to mention, and if he had not flirted with bringing the Soviet Union back into the Geneva agreements, Sadat and Begin would not have been pressured to come together and to, in a sense, force the United States into a Camp David kind of arrangement to take Russia as much as they could out of the Middle East. If one's standards for election of a president are 100% agreement to whatever the policies and programs of any government in Israel may be, no incumbent is ever going to measure up. Because the American national interest includes many interests which conflict with Israel's. If one is going to nominate and to vote for a man whose campaign rhetoric is 100% in favor of Israel, one will always find the non-incumbent having a perfect record. How much shall we trust campaign rhetoric? If Israel could bank all the fine things that have been said by those who ultimately won the highest office in our land, her relationship with America would be far different and far more secure than it is today. This is an election without a Jewish issue. Neither candidate is a Sonei Israel, an anti-Semite. Neither candidate is an Ohed Israel, a Philo-Semite. They have many issues and many concerns, and they will do what needs to be done according to their lights in the Middle East. Both, I think, appreciate the importance of Israel to the United States, an importance which was re-emphasized in these last few days as some of the complications and convolutions of the Iranian-Iraqi war have been played out. Israel will receive support from either administration. But whoever is in power, there will always be those who want to respond to the third world. There will always be those who are oil-related, who demand that the oil concerns be primary. Neither man will do all that Israel would like him to do. And I must say, add a word about Israel in all of this. Perhaps the most unfortunate part of this campaign has been the intrusions of Israeli into the American political process. I was shocked and saddened to see Ezer Weitzman, the former defense minister of Israel, as part of the Carter entourage here in Cleveland this week. And he's a rightsman, he's a nice man. But he has no place being in the middle of an American political campaign. There have been a number of indications from both the Anderson camp and the Reagan camp that they're very unhappy with the positions that Mr. Evron, our Israeli ambassador, and others have taken, emphasizing what they consider to be only the positive sides of the relationship between Israel and America during these last months. Now, an Israeli ambassador in Washington has a very difficult time during any American presidential campaign because our vote is still a crucial vote. But for a man who obviously would like to be elected Prime Minister of Israel, to campaign for that office by campaigning for one of the candidates for our office here is unconscionable. And I hope it is an act which will not be repeated on any side by any Israeli official at any time in the future. But why have there been these expensive advertisements in our local newspapers of Jews for Carter and Jews for Reagan? Well, because there are Americans for Carter and there are Americans for Reagan. What's been interesting is that most of the people who came out publicly for Mr. Reagan, though they pitched the advertisements to Israel, are really people who sympathize with his basic social philosophy, with that community of ideas having to do with work and freedom and defense, peace, and family, the more orthodox in our community. It's been also interesting that those who have come out for Mr. Carter, who represent more of the traditional establishment of our community, are doing so, though they write and speak in terms of Israel, largely because any number of the entitlements and of the programs which are important to their institutions have come out of this administration. They are protecting themselves in that respect. But whatever you do on Tuesday next, do it without any feeling that there is a Jewish issue in this campaign. There isn't, thank God. The issues are social. The issues are the confidence that you would place in one man and the other to guide us through some very complex international issues. The issues are, you know, who is the least likely to make mistakes? Who is the most likely to bring us to the point 4 years from now when hopefully other men are running for office and we can have greater hopes for the next presidency? Well, Rabbi, what are you going to do on Tuesday? Well, I'm going to vote for issue 5. And I want you to vote for issue 5. Issue 5 has to do with the restructuring of our county charter. It's a very important first step towards changing the nature of this terribly chopped up political world in which Tioga County and our area exists. No, I'm not going to break a 25-year tradition and tell you how I'm going to vote. I don't think that's my task or my purpose. I'm going to vote. And I have a long history of, almost an unbroken history of voting for losing candidates. But I think it's important that we go to the polls and exercise our franchise. There are many people running for office, not just the President of the United States. I'm reminded as I close of a story which is told about Abe Lincoln, whom I often think about as the Elijah of our American history. When the war was on, the White House, which had up till then been a fairly open place, was suddenly filled, as you might expect, with security people. They were afraid, and with good reason, for the life of Mr. Lincoln. And so when groups of people would come to visit the president, they would be ushered through the meeting room, but not allowed to shake hands, and they'd be pushed along by the military who were there. One particular day in one such levee, an old man was being pushed through, and he obviously had come a long way to see the president. And as he was sort of being pushed out the door, he turned and he shouted back to Mr. Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln, he said, I'm from Maine. I've come a long way, and I just want you to know that in Maine we believe that the Almighty God and Abe Lincoln alone can save the Union. Mr. Lincoln turned and he called back. He said, You're half right.
Amen.